Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by Ben Lockwin. If you're curious to hear about Ben's background, you can hear the last couple episodes that I did with him. In this episode, I talk to Ben about dealing with CDMOs and CXOs. We talk about supply chain and logistics in pharma and medical devices. We talk about reverse knowledge transfer, how to leverage your supplier's capabilities to help bolster your own knowledge, what building trust with CMOs looks like, how surveys are used, and the future of the CDMO market. I hope you enjoy this episode with Ben.
My thinking as far as supply chain goes is that it represents, whether we're talking about drugs or device, it's the beating heart of the manufacturing process. So the inputs that get transformed into outputs have to be selected, procured, and delivered via logistics, and then they have to be received, tested, and transported for the transformation to happen. And all of those steps represent the backbone of a high integrity supply chain. So if materials don't get where they need to be, then there is no manufacturing or production process. So I think the supply chain represents potentially one of the most critical cogs in the whole network, whether it is we're talking about drugs or device. And the logistics aspect, I think, is something that the people who do it well do it very well, and they prevent and offset a lot of risks. And when companies don't do it well, it can sometimes masquerade or be disguised as other kinds of production issues, and they don't really understand maybe the root cause of why they've got some issues. But in certain cases, those actually stem back to supply chain.
When you say logistics and the reduction of risk and kind of that part about masquerading like other issues, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so the logistics aspect to me is everything about the selection, transportation, high quality delivery of the supply chain. It's the component that companies like outside of the industry, like UPS, FedEx, and others, they thrive on logistics. And it's the part of the business model that represents the analysis and assessment and the operations of getting things to where they need to get to. So it's not just as simple, I think, as our listeners know, of picking the things you like and then they show up. We found out during the pandemic that when silicon wafer chips were stocking out, that had a tremendous impact on computer manufacturer, a tremendous impact on automobile manufacturer that needed the wafer chips for all of the smart tech screens and things in the vehicles. And in large part, that was production issues, but there were also logistical components. And so I always in my head think back to, again, I simplify things in my mind. And I think when I imagine good logistics, I think about companies that do it very well, like the UPSs and the FedEx, and they live and breathe on logistics. And every logistical detail about logistics matters to those companies. And we don't always maybe do things to the level in industry that some of those organizations do outside of the industry. So I think there's a lot of logistical things we can learn from other companies that are doing it very well. And if it has to be lessons taken outside of the industry, then so be it. I always think generalizing cases from out in the wild in the world really make for good situations to be able to draw from those insights, ideas, resources, and say, how can we put these into practice? And for sure, there are good high quality logistics. There have to be for drugs and devices. But I also think sometimes it can be a downfall. And then to your other question about the masquerading of risks. So if things aren't where they need to be because of supply chain gaffes, sometimes it looks like maybe a production issue. Oh, we couldn't start the manufacturing process because why? And then this is where you'd use tools like 5Ys, et cetera, fault tree analysis to work the problem backwards to then figure out what the issue was. Maybe we didn't have raw material tested on the shelf and ready to go. We had no buffer inventory to help us. Why was that? It's because dot. Maybe it was an ordering snafu. Maybe it was something else within the supply chain. Maybe it was a logistical transport problem. But oftentimes the production processes get dinged because of things that are sometimes outside of their control that have to do and stem back to supply chain.
Yeah, you're taking me back. I worked on a project years ago where one of the components was a spiked component that had a spike design that we found was performing appropriately. But once we started receiving the assembled material, we were like, well, the stopper is not piercing whatever it is it needs to. And the root cause of that was just the packaging. If you take the spikes off the line, they work completely fine. But if you put them in a box of 1,000 and they're co-located with a bunch of other spikes, then many of them become blunted over the course of their packaging, essentially. And so we had to come up with a kind of a unique packaging solution to solve that problem because it wasn't a... Perhaps you could have picked a different material or something like that that was more resilient to packaging, but there were other interactions at play. But that's a good point.
Yeah, and that's a great analogy too. If you think about on the drug side of the world, when animal testing occurs for new molecular entities, the animal models are fair, sometimes better, sometimes worse, fair proxies for in vivo metabolism of a drug, toxicity, et cetera. But it's not really until you get it into first in human and then you're dosing human patients that you can really know anything. So, you know, in your example with the spikes there, in isolation, these things just work great. But when you order them or they're shipped on particular lot sizes or packaging conformations or whatever, they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing in the real world.
So we were talking before we started recording about, at least I should say, I was saying that I sometimes see from a quality point of view, expansion, contraction that happens just around culture. So I remember years and years ago, I started seeing companies go away from decentralized kind of quality systems now more towards enterprise or centralized quality systems. And I think the same can be true as far as CMOs, CDMOs, etc. I feel this is for sure completely based anecdotally and on perception that the appetite for outsourcing now is greater than I've ever seen it in my career. I'm wondering from your point of view, having worked with so many different clients, varying sizes and internal at kind of CXOs, outside of the culture, like how do you go about thinking, is this something that I should do in-house? Is this something that I should try and outsource? And there's always a question of, is this a capability that I need to build or is this something that I can outsource?
Yeah, in large part, those decisions are based on what kind of operational infrastructure exists in the organization. Is it even possible in the near-term future to line up your ability to produce a new drug or a new device. Let's stick with drugs for the moment. So can you even do it if it's a monoclonal antibody or versus a small molecule or a cell therapy or a gene therapy? So you may find very quickly that a very cursory assessment of what you have for production infrastructure disallows you to do that in-house. Another component in a lot of cases is talent, and talent shortages beget operational shortfalls. So if you don't have the right number, the volume of talent that you need to be able to bring something in-house or continue to manufacture in-house, you may find that the talent part of the equation is something that's driving you to use a CDMO or a CMO in order to get everything that you need when you need it. And then there's also, of course, the offsetting of risk elements. There's always risks in the production process, in the development process, and companies often like to avail themselves of CDMOs for this reason, because they have the talent, they've got the operational infrastructure, presuming they have empty slots to be able to do the development, the scale up, the production for your particular molecule. They oftentimes, going back to your centralized, decentralized kind of idea, they offer the one-stop shop sort of approach where they are absorbing some of the risk. And the Code of Federal Regulations would, of course, say the sponsor company is responsible for overseeing all of the aspects of quality at the end of the day. But the CDMOs and CMOs oftentimes have very high quality groups, regulatory groups. They've done this a lot, bringing molecules through phase one, phase two, phase three, to and through approval, post-marketing surveillance, maybe pharmacovigilance, things like that. So they've got the talent, they've got the operational chops, they've done this kind of stuff enough times where the repetition has led to mastery in a lot of cases. If I think back to some of the top CDMOs like the group Thermo Fisher, Catalent, WuXi, Samsung, Fujifilm, Recipharm, there's many, but the ones who do this a lot are very good at what they do. And it offers an opportunity to centralize a lot of the work. And that then gives freedom to the sponsor organizations to work on other things rather than get wrapped up in their own development, scale up, production, which could be very lucrative for sure. But if they don't have, again, the infrastructure, maybe they don't have the manufacturing capacity, maybe they don't have the talent, enough people ready to go, it may be an easier choice than some realize to say, you know what, let's get this thing done by a CXO.
I was listening to a podcast some weeks ago, and it had nothing to do with pharma or medical devices. It was talking about content, actually, of all things. And this guy was talking about how he used to look at getting agencies to help him with content creation where he would fully outsource. And then he had a big background in coaching from a fitness point of view. And he got to the point where he thought, I'm hiring them to teach me and in some ways to work themselves out of my life. And I think the reason that that sparked kind of this in my head is I'm like, there's always transfer one direction for sure from the sponsor to the CMO. Have you seen anything where there's transfer back from the CMO to the sponsor?
Yes.
Where I maybe miss, just looking at like APQP, for example, has the PPAP framework that outlines how to transfer to your CMO to ensure that they understand what it is that they're making, how it is that they're measuring, the extent to which that they're measuring, and so on. But I think where I maybe see a missing piece, and again, it's just my subjective limited experience, is you can build a competency as your
leveraging the capabilities of an external party, I think. And I haven't seen a good framework for that.
Yeah, I definitely have seen that happen. So if I start with your example of the content development, so the reason that in my mind is a little bit different is because you've got, let's say, an individual who says, I need content development done. I'm going to look to a shop to do this. And as they're doing it, and I'm getting back copy edits, drafts, I'm helping with red lines, whatever it is, you're seeing the evolutionary process. And if you have the drive, the determination, and frankly, the interest, you can then learn along the way, internalize some of that learning. So there's a knowledge transfer coming back to you, or in this case, back to him, where he's getting more efficient and effective at content development by seeing the experts do it. The difference that I see, if you're at a sponsor organization, you use a CDMO or a CMO, that same opportunity exists. And I've seen a lot of situations where the sponsor companies actually learn quite a bit from what the CXO is doing, because at what they do, they're often the best at it. They're better in a lot of cases than the sponsor company. But the difference is, there are so many roles involved. If you were in, let's say, MS&T, MSAT, or Tech Ops, or something like that, you could work with your CDMO partner or your CMO partner. Those individuals are getting a lot of knowledge transfer, or maybe it's the regulatory teams of the two companies figuring out how to, as you said, the making part of the equation, the measuring part of the equation. That's all stuff that is occurring in tandem, and the individual roles that are partnering and pairing up, they're growing and learning together. But then to take that in totality and say, okay, so at the sponsor company, what did you all learn by outsourcing this molecule to this CDMO? That's a very nuanced and difficult question to answer, because now you're talking about 15, 20, 50 different roles potentially that have liaised and engaged through knowledge transfer over the course of many months. And so to totally quantify that in a package and say, here's how we've upskilled our sponsor organization because of this partnership, is something that very rarely happens. So the knowledge transfers are happening. Any robust quantification of what's been transferred is non-existent.
Like, just spitballing here, do you think it would be good? Because if you have the ability to document transfer one way, does it stand to reason that you would be able to document it the other way? Just from a demonstrating competence point of view.
For sure. Yep. Yeah. Knowledge transfer can certainly be measured bidirectionally. And it's like Kirkpatrick's different levels of training assessment. So the first level being like surveys that you give out to people. So let's say you run a training class or any kind of knowledge transfer. It's really those questions like, did you like it? Yes, no. Oh, I did a survey. I sat in this knowledge transfer, this training. Yeah, it was fine. The speaker was engaging or whatever. But that's really an unhelpful overall measurement of anything that's going on. But as you go through Kirkpatrick's four stages, the kind of the fourth stage of things at the top of the pyramid is, did it change overall performance? So were organizational behaviors altered? Did it change decision making at a function level, a business unit level, because of what happened in the knowledge transfer? So I think if you want to look at in either of those directions, transferring from one to the other or from the other back to the initiator, you can certainly measure and document. It would just require the interest to do
so. You recently wrote an article about CDMOs specifically, and there were two things that you highlighted that I thought were interesting. One was just the forecast. I'll let you speak to that, but it seems like CDMOs are only growing. And then you talk about trust, and as quality professionals, this is a stupid question for sure, but quantifying trust, how do you measure that? Trust is earned, not given. And the 100 other quotes that are like that, I'm just wondering what, if you can speak to those two.
Yeah. So we'll start on the trust piece. There was a book called The Leadership Challenge by Kouzis and Posner. It was required reading for a long time in a lot of different business schools, but they had always found, they had done several redundant surveys of organizations internationally. And when they looked at what was the most important set of features, as far as leadership is concerned in business, it always came back to trust. The number one element every time they surveyed, and this was across most, virtually all companies that they would survey, the trust part of the equation always ranked either very highly or it was the principal element. So I think when companies engage with a CDMO or a CMO, the trust part of the equation absolutely has to be kept paramount. And it's also one that's very difficult. So some of these partnerships, if it's in a relatively matured model, they'll do partnership surveys between the sponsor organization and the CXO to make sure that they're hopefully measuring what matters and that there is a high level of trust. And if not, they need to go back to the drawing board and figure out, maybe by survey comments, where are things going wrong in the partnership? Why are we lagging in this particular indicator of trust or something else about the partnership?
What are those indicators? Because that's where I was going, is that I think on principle, I completely agree. Hmm. Trust is, I think, built in any relationship, right? You need to have a kind of a undeniable track record of I trust you, you trust me at an individual level. And I think the surveys sound like they would be a really nice tool for just being transparent around where we are. But what are those measures?
In a lot of cases, they're pretty much written just like that. So if you said, what are the antecedents to trust? What sorts of things should you survey about trust? There's a lot of literature out there, but in large part, the surveys themselves will ask questions like, deadlines are met on time or early, in every case, agree or disagree, something like that. Or even as transparent as, I trust my partner and peer at the other organization with whom I work, agree, disagree. Or maybe there's like a Likert scale, 5 to 7 scoring rank kind of thing. So I think a lot of these surveys, in order to be as easy to administer as possible, are really trying to get at the trust question by just directly asking the trust question, or they're trying to infer a level of trust in the overall survey outcomes based on answers to other questions. But if you asked a question, do I trust the work that my peer at this other organization, do I trust their work? Do I trust their ability to meet deadlines? Do I trust their ability to communicate clearly and authentically? Things like this, those become less of a surrogate or a proxy measure. And you're really asking directly, hey, survey respondent, do you trust this relationship? I think the problem is if you don't have freeform comments then, and you score relatively low, like, no, I don't trust this partner, and then there's no other follow-up, you can get low ranked scores overall. Let's say the overall average score could be fairly low, but then you don't really know how to attack that. How do we pull this score up if we don't know what's behind it? So a lot of these surveys will have freeform fill in the comment box. And that's good too, but if you're trying to aggregate results, you run into all the same survey gaffes as survey experts run into all the time. How do you affinitize answers? How do you look for particular keywords when people are typing in sentences or paragraphs, and you have to group all those together and say, this one kind of looks like this other one, so we'll lump these together. And in aggregate, that looks like an issue of, I don't know, communication.
Too many, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. transparency, communication, too many emails, too few phone calls, or too many phone calls, too few emails, whatever it happens to be. So you want to be able to move the needle by going after the things that matter. But at the end of the day, too, any tool, because you mentioned it being a tool, which is very true. Surveys are really only a tool, and they're like a map. And a map is really just a metaphor for the terrain. So until you're really in the situation, trying to say the survey is telling us something is like saying a map is telling me what this terrain is like. It gives you a close approximation, but you're collapsing the Z dimension, right? There's no height on your map. So you're really trying to follow this thing north, south, east, west, with as much information as you can get, but it doesn't include, you know, on your 2D map, it doesn't include things like, you know, what's the weather going to be as I go on my hike? Or did it just rain the prior week and now the ground is difficult to cross over here? So until you actually get into the situation, you won't know what you're facing. And similarly, the survey results are only as good as survey results can be as a snapshot in time.
And the forecast?
Yeah, what we do know about the industry is that it's about $136 billion market segment as of last year. And the compound annual growth rate for CDMOs, CMOs is in the 6 to 7% range, forecasted out to 2030. And what that basically means is by 2030, we're talking about $235+ billion. So it's the CXO side of the market is going to transform into about $250 billion. APIs will continue to have the largest revenue share of the market. And I think the direction
is that,
you know,
right?
There's
APIs?
Yeah. Yep.
I'm not a drug person, but can you elaborate on that? I should say I'm not a drug person as far as drug substance goes.
Yeah, a lot of the companies are saying what we want to do is have the formulation done of the active pharmaceutical ingredient, and then we'll either use your organization for final formulation or we'll send it somewhere else. So a lot of the CDMOs, CMOs find themselves in the API part of the equation. And at the moment, it's the largest revenue share of the CDMO market. And in particular, if we look at therapeutic areas, oncology drugs are the largest share of activity. So they're representing about a third, like 35% of the CDMO activity at the moment. Past performance, not being a guarantee, but being a pretty good precursor of future potential. We should then assume that heading up to that 2030 marker, that oncology will continue to lead the way. And I think that represents a lot of growing interest in different molecular targets in the cancer space that have been refined over the past decade. And also there's a certain fashionicity to medical therapy development. And what I mean by that is not every drug that, and devices, by the way, that are potentially for the most needed diseases and disorders get the most attention. Instead, it's based on sales figures, it's based on forecast, it's based on what people hear in the media. And at the end of the day, what's getting the most attention? The fashion of certain types of drugs, like the GLP-1 drugs now for blood sugar control and for weight loss. Once those things capture the public's attention through media outlets, they become part of this fashionicity. Looking back through the history of drug and device development, we've got these periods of fashion. Your sport coat lapels get wider and then they get narrower. Your ties get wider, they get narrower. Dresses get long, then they get short, then they get longer again. And that's what we see with the overall timeline of drug development. Is there's these little pockets that represent pieces and slices of time where you could look back to a 3 to 5 year period and say, oh, that was the era of second generation antipsychotics or antidepressants. And that was really at the time what captured the public interest, like the Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft era. That was a thing in time. And we find ourselves in that situation. But I think that notwithstanding, the oncology market's a big one. And there's been a lot of really great research going on and continues to go on with, frankly, a lot of therapeutic areas, oncology in particular, because cancer isn't just cancer. I think we all know people in our families, direct family members or extended family. And certainly if we expand that to friends, we've all got people who are impacted by cancer. And not all cancer is cancer. And that's why, frankly, oncologists have such a hard job, because they don't all look the same and they don't all respond to treatments the same. If they did, it would be easy and we would have already cured it or fixed it. There are certainly types of cancer that we've gotten much, much better at increasing survivability, reducing mortality. But then there are others where there's a long way to go, but certainly the pioneers out there are making it such that as we participate in this industry and we actualize what these forecasts mean over time, we're also tactically getting better over time at prolonging life, improving the quality of life. And I think it's overall a good story for patients and for the market.
Where could people find you, Ben?
Probably LinkedIn is the easiest way, I would say.
Very good. Appreciate you coming on and talking to CDMO. This is awesome.
Thank you, Subi. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.